With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that gets right under the skin of science, in a good way. Isaac Asimov once said the most exciting phrase to hear in science is not Eureka, but that's funny, and respectfully, we think you can have a bit of both. I'm Rick Edwards, this is my manservant.
I'm Dr. Michael Brooks, not a manservant.
It's sweet that you don't think you're a manservant. This is a show where we invite an expert to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. How do we come up with the interesting questions? We just conjure them out of nowhere.
Yeah, we basically think, what am I interested in?
Yeah, what do I want to know the answer to?
Yeah, and we don't like to Google, so, you know, we'll go away and do some serious work on it.
Yeah, just do some thinking. Just do some thinking, come up with a good question, and then come up with some answers. And today's, I've got to tell you...
What have you got?
This is mine. It's an absolute doozy.
Go on.
In this episode, we're going to be exploring, will we ever talk to animals?
Oh, I mean, I talk to my dog all the time, basically saying, what the fuck?
will we have a shared
language?
Why did
you bite my father-in-law?
Was it? Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Bit your father-in-law?
Bit my father-in-law on Boxing Day evening. Yeah.
Well, there's a clear message in there somewhere.
Well, the message is don't go to A&E on Boxing Day evening because you'll be there till 4 a.m. and still not have the tetanus shot.
How bad was the bite?
It was quite bad, to be honest. Yeah, it was quite deep. I mean, she really went for it.
What provoked her?
He came too close while right. She was a bit dozy and sleepy. And then she wakes up, sees a hand dangling in front of her and it's like, right, bite that off.
I mean, I shouldn't laugh, but I haven't got another reaction. It was funny.
Anyway, so I mean, as well as being able to say, you know, what the fuck, I'd like to be able to just say, so why are you like this, Rafi? Because it's not the first time.
Yeah, she's got history.
Yeah. I mean, at least she's not biting me anymore. Touch wood.
Yeah, I guess that she's definitely warm to you.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
It does take time.
Yeah.
It's not, you're not an easy person to love.
I mean, she's only known me for 3 years, so, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and when did I start to like you? It was about sort of 3 years in. I'm totally with her. Human fascination with animals dates back to our earliest known history, with animals and humans living side by side for thousands of years. But just how close are we to breaking the communication barrier? Over half of UK households own at least one pet, so whether it's a fish who's never ventured further than your kitchen counter or a puppy you bought during lockdown to pass the lonely hours working from home, if you're listening to this show, there's a pretty high chance that you live with an animal or you have at some point in your life. I, for one, would love to be able to tell my cat to stop scratching my furniture and ask her, what do you want from me? As well as pondering what our pets would say if they could, on today's episode we're discussing apes who may have gained the ability to communicate using American Sign Language, a unique system that sea creatures use to communicate amongst themselves underwater, and as always, we'll be asking one of the world's leading experts to answer our question, will we ever talk to animals?
So, as ever, Rick, it sounds like we have a brilliant mind to tell us all about this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to let you down here, am I? We have... Barbara J. King, Emerita Professor of Anthropology at the College of William and Mary, the author of 7 books on animals. Her How Animals Grieve has been translated into 7 languages. Her newest book is just out. It's called Animals' Best Friends, putting compassion to work for animals in captivity and the wild. And because obviously you've got to start somewhere, we kicked off by asking her which animals have the most potential for effective communication with humans.
The projects that get the most attention tend to be those with our closest living relatives, which are great apes. These are chimpanzees and bonobos and gorillas, perhaps also creatures of the ocean like dolphins. And in this case, we ask them to learn our communication systems. For example, ASL, which is American Sign Language, or using printed symbols on cards. And there's definitely success in talking with animals that way. But we're asking an animal to come at communication the human way, often in captivity. Some years ago, I flew down to the state of Georgia, which is in the American South, to meet the really famous bonobo called Kanzi. And he was at the time at Georgia State University in a project run by Dr. Sue Savage-Rumbaugh. And he has been for years very famous in ape language circles because he was never taught to communicate directly. Rather, researchers were trying to teach his mother how to work with human symbols. And Kanzi, as a little youngster, just kind of picked this up really spontaneously. It turned out that Kanzi was really good at using these symbols and also understanding some human speech. So the symbols are called lexigrams, and he used a lexigram board as he got older to communicate by pointing to symbols. And I pretty much got off the airplane and arrived at this research facility and met Kanzi, and he looked me over. He took his lexigram board and he touched the symbols for a sentence, visitor chase, ? And that made sense. He didn't know me, but he thought we might play together, and we did. So I was wearing blue jeans and I had a small ball in my pocket that I brought him that he couldn't see. And he looked hard at me again. And then he asked, egg, ? And of course, at that point, I felt bad that I didn't have an egg. But in other words, we did have a conversation, and he and his sister, Pambanisha, were capable of much more complicated conversations than that.
So I have heard of Kanzi. But what I've heard is that it's not as straightforward as some people have said in terms of ability to use language.
Right. That's exactly the nub of it. I think what this all comes down to really is that we desperately want to believe, and by we, I mean us in general, but also the researchers involved in the work, want to believe that we can have conversations and communicate with the great apes.
Yeah.
Like we deep in our souls, we want to believe that's happening. And that means that a lot of the research that has been held up as an example of exactly that is quite questionable.
So is there a bit of wishful thinking going on?
A load of wishful thinking. And so you can see why you'd start off with the great apes, because they're our closest relatives. Yeah. And when you look at them in the wild, they definitely use gestures. And you can see interesting things like orangutans in captivity appear to have a load of gestures that they do that they just don't do out in the wild. So they're developing, you know, certain kind of... Right. And you wouldn't necessarily call it language, but cues to try and get things that they want, or get, you know, one of the other orangutans
to do something. Aren't they?
They're communicating some idea or some want. Generally, it is a want. And it's interesting that they develop more in captivity. And then you look at chimps, and they're using quite a lot of gestures out in the wild. I think at the last count, you could find kind of 66 discrete gestures. And so, you know, researchers back in the, I think it's sort of early 20th century, started thinking, okay, well, maybe we'll be able to, you know, decipher some of this or teach them some of our language.
Yeah.
Now, you immediately rule out the idea that they're going to be able to actually sort of speak a human language just because of the structures of our larynx and voice box and stuff are just so different.
Yeah,
so they just can't make those sounds. So then you think, okay, American Sign Language. Let's see if we can teach them American Sign Language. So a common language, very much our language, not trying to sort of learn theirs, but say, this is ours, can you learn this? And, you know, over the years, there was lots of excitement, and there are lots of examples where people said, well, look at this. So the most famous one is Coco, who you probably will have heard of. Coco died, I think, 4 years ago. There was massive press, and she was the gorilla who everyone said had mastered American Sign Language.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And was like...
and had met met lots of famous people. So had met Robin Williams one afternoon. Yeah, there's some great footage of Robin Williams sort of playing around with Coco, and it's very endearing. And apparently when they told Coco that Robin Williams had died, Coco was very sad and
really?
Reflective. Now, that very clearly is not true. What Coco probably was doing was reacting to her handler's
and emotional state.
I mean, to be honest, if I've met someone once, you know, 15 years before, I'm not necessarily...
You're not going to be terribly sad that they've died.
I don't think I am. But also, when you look at the stuff that this lady was doing with Coco, I believe that she believed she was communicating and that Coco was sort of reasonably competent with American Sign Language. Most other researchers don't. It looks like Coco is just guessing. Always, and kind of trying to read what the researcher wants. So just trying to guess to give the researcher what they want so that then they will get affection or food.
Yeah.
So it all seems to be motivated by affection and food.
So it's not fraud, it's just, you know, researchers sort of not really questioning themselves
closely. So. And they're not providing any data. That's the other thing that lots of other sort of serious kind of primatologists and neurologists have looked at and said, well, where is the data? And they just won't share the data.
So it's sort of anecdotal reports is all you get.
Yeah, which isn't really good enough. So I wanted to read out a little, just because this really made me laugh. Back in 1998, Coco did an AOL chat, which dates it nicely. So live, online, and there's an excerpt here, and it's fantastic. So question comes in. What are the names of your kittens and dogs? Coco, Foot. his trainer, Patterson. Oh, Foot isn't the name of your kitty. And another question. Coco, what's the name of your cat? Coco, no. Patterson. She just gave some vocalizations there, some soft puffing. And then someone else says, oh, yeah, I heard that soft puffing. And Patterson says, now shaking her head, no. Next question. Do you like to chat with other people? Coco, fine nipple. Patterson. Ah, yeah. Nipple rhymes with people. She doesn't sign people per se. She was just trying to do a sounds like. Yeah, right.
It's basically like interviewing Liam Gallagher, isn't it?
Yeah, but sort of worse.
Like, worse.
It's like, it's nonsense. Yeah, it's just nonsense stuff. And then the trainer desperately trying to try and explain it away.
I mean, can we excuse that by she didn't really want to do this? A publicist hadn't agreed to the interview, or there were certain subjects were off limits.
Coco didn't want to do it.
Yeah, maybe Coco said, I don't want any questions about the cat.
I guess, I suppose we have to entertain that possibility. I'm going with it's all a crock. I think on the whole. Also, Coco was obsessed with nipples.
Nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with it. I guess, but there was a bit of, I think I probably have to tread carefully here because I think it's sort of legally a bit fraught. There's definitely some issues with visitors, other research assistants, not liking the fact that they were being asked to show their nipples to Coco because Coco likes nipples.
Oh, that's just murky, isn't it?
And then Patterson always kind of saying, "Oh no, it's using the no, it's a sounds like, it's a sounds like." You go, no, she points at the nipple, and when you show her a nipple, she likes it. So, so it's kind of,
okay. We're definitely not really very convinced by Coco.
It's a load of old baloney. Really. And when there's a guy called Herbert Terrace who had a chimp in the 60s and 70s who tried to take a much more sort of rigorous approach. And his chimp was called Nim Chimpsky.
Oh, yeah.
Which is good fun. Nice. Because Noam Chomsky goes on about how language is unique to humans. So it's kind of a pun on that. Very funny. But Terrace, his conclusion was pretty much none of the stuff that we're seeing is anything but just guesswork.
Okay.
And the researchers kind of trying to cover that up, but probably not consciously, or just if they give the wrong answer, reacting like the ape is being funny.
Excusing them. Basically.
Yeah, he's kidding.
Yeah.
And no, that is a silly answer, but that's his sense of humour. and you're like, I don't know if it is. And the thing with all of the ASL stuff is it's just open to interpretation. So if you want to think that you're seeing the right symbol at the right time, then you're going to... Whereas the lexigrams that that Kanzi uses, that Barbara mentioned, much less susceptible to that. So they're quite specific. And he gets those right sort of about 9 times out of 10.
Okay.
And he's just pointing to them. And sometimes he can string stuff together, not quite sort of sentences you wouldn't say.
But you know what he's meaning or getting
at. Yeah. And things like, if you change the order of 3 words, then he'll understand that you want a slightly different action with with these objects. So there's a kind of degree
quite sort of
sophistication.
Very basic, toddler, very almost pre-toddler sort of communication.
Basic, but still something.
Yeah, yeah.
But like I say, very much sort of relying on him sort of adjusting to what we're presenting as this is how we want you to communicate.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Not really trying to sort of decipher anything that he might be offering himself.
So obviously that's the great apes, and we probably project more of ourselves onto them anyway. So there must be other animals that are intelligent that sort of, you know, we can't really identify with in the same way, but maybe still exhibit some forms of communication that we could work with.
Yeah, you're right. We do need to look outside the great apes. And I mean, you know me, we're never going to get through a question like this without me bringing in the octopuses.
Of course.
Because
not.
You've got to. But for once, this doesn't come from me, though. This is Professor Barbara herself.
Yeah, I can blame her.
When asked what other types of animals were ripe for...
You're just encouraging him.
Yeah, she is, but I love it. When we said, OK, who else is going to be doing some high-level communication? She had this to say.
All right.
So I can't be held accountable.
I think that there are potentials with many types of animals. For example, I am quite fascinated with cephalopods. These include octopus, cuttlefish, and squid. And we know, for example, in recent years that octopus are just incredibly intelligent and they flash their moods on their skin. They have distributed cognition, so their brains exist in their arms as well as in the part of the body that's considered the head. But also they have what are called chromatophores on their body. And so if they're very highly aroused and excited, they may turn red. And if they're not feeling well or in some cases dying, they can turn pale. And, you know, we find it a sort of an unusual experience to try to communicate with octopus because they're so different than the mammals that we typically try to communicate. And I'm not suggesting that we can tell exactly what an octopus is communicating when they communicate to each other, but we can tell something about their emotional state. And this opens up a new landscape of understanding how much animals think and feel.
So this, I think, is the absolute key. If you're going to try and understand animal communication, an animal isn't going to be able to tell you whether you're right. So you have to try and figure it out from context. And context, certainly in the sea, is really difficult. Because the animals are moving around so quickly, they're so hard to track, to work out where the sound is coming from, all this kind of stuff. Mm. And people are looking at ways of trying to get around that. But the octopus, unfortunately, I think you sort of have to discount here. I mean, the amazing thing about all of those colour displays that octopuses do is they're sort of just screaming into the void because they're solitary animals.
Right, so, they so they're literally just like railing around angry like with the world or whatever.
Yeah. Or whatever they are, happy with the world. Like they're not, they're it's just like a one-way broadcast. there's nothing there that is able to decipher what it's saying.
Yeah.
So it's really eccentric. I mean, they're very eccentric in lots of ways, octopuses. Yeah. But I think that I would probably...
But they sort of wear their heart on their sleeve, effectively.
Their three hearts on their sleeves.
The three hearts on their eight sleeves. Yeah.
Yeah, and heartbreakingly, no one could see it.
No one's looking. No one cares.
And even if someone is looking, they're just like, don't know what you mean, mate.
No, no idea what that red is.
Really frustrating. very, very
well. Presumably they're just like, you know, they're not that frustrated by it. So does this maybe tell us something about the fact that it's not really communication as stuff as such? It's just a reflection of internal states.
Yeah, a little bit, and it does come down to what you mean by communicating or talking to an animal. If you want a conversation where they're able to converse in one of our languages,
yeah,
I think you're going to be sorely disappointed.
Yeah.
But you might be able to be in a position where you do understand what they are trying to communicate to other members of their species or even
yeah,
us. But you're always trying to piece the stuff together from context, because the animal, whatever the animal is, it's never going to be able to tell you. That's the whole point.
Yeah. I mean, that's the problem.
Why it is
yeah,
doing the thing it's doing,
yeah,
or what it's trying to communicate. So you have to try and deduce it from what is happening, how other things are reacting. And with the octopus, that's difficult. A, because they're solitary. B, because it's underwater, and that poses loads of problems anyway.
Yeah.
In terms of how you sort of follow the action, if you like. Yeah, like getting to the bottom of what an octopus is trying to express, if anything, feels like a very, very difficult task, which is sad.
It doesn't mean they're not communicating.
No.
It doesn't mean they're not.
No,
it's just
means
we can't make sense of it necessarily.
Not at the moment.
That's really disappointing. Really.
It is a little bit disappointing, yes.
Anything else? I mean, any other creatures we can actually tap into properly?
So, as you'd expect, artificial intelligence will have quite a big part to play in this. So if you look at something like a prairie dog, so what's great about prairie dogs is their context and their environment is very easy to monitor, because they stay in one place.
Yeah.
They live in, it's called like a town. You can identify individuals and you can see exactly what they do, and you can kind of work out what it's a response to or what it's anticipating, and you can see what the other prairie dog's behavior, how it changes. And so you can really start to try and piece together what their calls might mean.
Yeah.
So there's an animal behaviorist called Kon Slobodchikov who has been studying prairie dogs, and he's using AI to monitor and then look for patterns and so on in the prairie dog calls. And he thinks that they can definitely identify different types of predator to each other.
Yeah.
They can describe its size. They can say its color. So they would be able to say there's a human approaching and the human is wearing blue, for example.
Right.
So they're kind of quite sophisticated predator alerts.
Yeah.
And even, I think even shape, like it's quite, they're quite discreet.
Yeah.
There's quite a surprising level of detail, I suppose.
But there's a guy coming, he's a shapeless blue hoodie.
Yeah.
I mean, it just looks like he hasn't made any effort at all.
Yeah. And we're like, probably don't need to worry about him too much. Yeah. he looks down on his luck. And then there's also chatter in between the bits where you kind of go, okay, you're saying there's a hawk coming and it's blah blah. There's also just chatter between the prairie dogs that doesn't seem to be performing any particular purpose. They might just be small talk.
So it's like nattering away just to fill the silence, sort of thing.
Yeah, which is very, very human.
Yeah, very human.
But you don't see it very much in the animal kingdom. Generally, the communication, because it's, I mean, what we're not saying is that animals don't communicate. It's very clear that animals communicate the whole time.
Yeah.
We just struggle to understand what it means.
Yeah.
What we don't see is a great deal of just kind of, chatter.
So these guys are just sort of, you know, shooting the breeze.
Possibly, yeah.
Just to aid social interaction, which is good for cohesion in the group, which is exactly what we do, isn't
it? Yes, exactly.
It's like, you know, you've got to be good at small talk because, you know, otherwise people won't like you very much.
It lubricates the social engine.
Yeah, exactly.
And that possibly is what the prairie dogs are doing as well.
Yeah.
So they're pretty interesting. And the professor thinks that within kind of 10, this is a classic cold fusion one actually, within about 10 years, he will have a device, like a phone-sized device that can translate what the prairie dogs are saying, but also probably something for like domestic pets.
Bullshit.
Well, I think I was trying to sort of, I was trying to kind of go back through the archives. I think, to be fair, he has been saying that for a while. Next few years.
Yeah, yeah, it's coming soon. Just as soon as Fusion arrives.
Mm.
Well, just before that, in fact.
But there is, you know, I think AI could really open stuff up in a way that we would never have been able to do beforehand, just because it can look at huge swathes of data.
Yeah, and it's about recognising patterns, which is exactly what words are, effectively, and what communications are.
And we can't do that just by sort of pure sort of our endeavour. Like we just don't have the capacity, whereas AI does.
Yeah.
And so another really interesting area for that will be underwater, so with dolphins and whales. And we know that dolphins and whales have quite sort of rich communication. We see that dolphins appear to have kind of signature whistles that you could, a slight push, I think, say, act like names. You see that they, so there's two groups of dolphins that are different species that meet in Costa Rica, I think it is. And they use different sounds then, so that sounds that they don't use any of the rest of the time, like a common language, like sort of dolphin Esperanto, which is pretty
right,
amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you feel like, okay, there's a real potential there. Now, similar to the octopus, you have the same problem, which is, how am I working out where the sound is coming from, like keeping up with the dolphins, like the context part of working out what
how
is
would
being,
you begin to is, know what it is they're actually sort of trying to communicate?
Yeah, it's really, really tough. But researchers are working on it with little, so that, I mean, it's quite fun stuff actually. So little like soft robotic fish swimming around with receivers in, listening out, sort of dangling little microphones in, putting suction cups actually like onto, I think sperm whales are the ones that seem to have a very kind of rich language. Little suction cup sort of monitors onto them. So you're starting to monitor their language and all of their sounds and how they react to them. And then plugging that into an AI. So you put your machine learning algorithms on it and you look for, essentially, you're looking for patterns. And what would be amazing is if you could see a pattern. So this has been done with human languages. I didn't find this surprising, but I don't know if it's just because I already knew what the result was. But see what you think. When researchers first tried to create this massive sort of like 300-dimensional cloud of a language, so let's say the English language, and all of the words have these quite specific sort of vector relations to one another. And so you come with this sort of unimaginable cloud, I guess, because so many dimensions.
Yeah.
But then, you know, an AI can see patterns within it. And then you do the same thing for Japanese, and linguists thought, well, you're not going to see any particular match here because they're totally different languages. And actually, you see a lot of repeated patterns. They don't like map one to one, but it's very similar.
Right.
And I thought, yeah, that kind of makes sense because they're just descriptions of the world.
Of getting on with life, isn't like it? Whether you're underwater or whether you're sort of...
Well, no. So this is my sort of worry, in fact, is that like the world of the Japanese speaker and the world of the English speaker is very similar, fundamentally.
Yeah.
Living in a very similar world. Similar, they're going to have similar emotions, similar things you're dealing with, like...
But you think the dolphin thing is...
But the underwater world,
the underwater is going to be so different.
It's going to be very, like, what... Maybe, like, familial relations would be the same. There will be some shared stuff, but I wouldn't be...
It's still going to be, like, where's the food? And
yeah. And so maybe that would be the dream is...
Who's this coming over here? I don't like the look of them.
Yeah. What's that suction cup for?
Can someone get this suction cup off my back?
That's never a real fish. but the idea is maybe you'll come up with this cloud and you might be able to see some mirroring with a human language cloud.
I mean, it's worth a try, isn't it? I mean,
you could be quids in.
Yeah, yeah. It'd be amazing if it worked.
There's a lady who's doing something really interesting with dolphins, using a thing called CHAT, which stands for cetacean hearing and telemetry, I think. And she's trying to create new words, basically, for the dolphins. So she's kind of... They don't appear, as far as you can see, don't appear to have a name or a sort of noise for a particular type of seaweed. So she's kind of trying to push it on them
really?
To see if when she's not around with her little sort of audio box, if they'll use it. Which I quite like.
God. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's just basically
drip feed in a bit.
It's like with you when you were trying to get everyone to say how's he all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
And nobody took that up. And maybe the dolphins were just like, fucking hell.
Yeah, I mean, if the dolphins are the first ones to go with how's he, I'd be delighted. I don't know if dolphins brag that much.
Oh, I bet they do.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah, absolutely. Love themselves, don't they, dolphins?
On that note, let's take a quick break. We'll be back after this to hear what is quite a funny story about an animal you wouldn't expect to be communicating with humans. Plus, Professor Barbara King will be getting to the bottom of this week's question, will we ever talk to animals?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So I think the prairie dog stuff is really interesting. I think the dolphins and the whales, really interesting as well. AI is obviously going to be massively useful. Now, having said all of that, Professor King does have a very interesting story relating to animal communication that I think, no, scrub that, that I know you're going to really enjoy. What is the last animal that you would expect to be effectively communicating with a human? I just have any guess.
I'm saying rabbit for some reason.
Yeah, rabbit's not bad, but it's not rabbit. Bring out the chickens.
Years ago, a friend of mine who lives in New Jersey told me about a flock of hens that she kept at her house, and she cared well for them, and she knew them as individuals. She also had a swimming pool. One day she was in part of her house and she heard a kind of frantic knocking noise at her door that sounded unusual to her, and she went to it and found that a number of these hens had come to alert her to the fact that one of the hens had fallen into the pool and was in serious trouble of drowning. So they actually were able to understand a problem, understand that the person in the house would likely want to help, and how to come and get them and to communicate with them. And my books are full of examples of animals that are able to understand how to bridge the divide and communicate with us. And that's one that I like very much. And I believe that a panic response on the part of the hens would have been much more disorganized and not directed directly at her to get her attention. They diverted their path, these hens, you know, away from the pool to seek her attention. And I found that notable.
Well,
okay, there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah. but I mean, first of all, are you having that?
I find it so hard to believe, but I like it. I mean, I like the idea that the chickens were just like, do you know who can help here? That big one over there, that big thing that gives us our food. Maybe it's like praying. It's like, you know, this is the effectively like, you know, the chickens saw her as God, able to intervene. As maybe I'm ascribing a bit too much intellect to the chickens
that's
now.
That's not working for me. I think this is an absolutely classic example of what the people with the great apes.
It's wishful thinking, isn't it?
I think so.
It is. It's the chickens panicked. They ran around madly and happened to bump into the glass.
Mm.
Knocked at the door.
Yeah.
By accident.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost certainly the case, isn't it?
Unfortunately, yeah. But I do. But I want to believe it.
Yeah, it's not that I don't want it to be true.
No,
it's just you know, you would expect if there was that level of cognition to say, shit, there's a big problem here. I need some intervention. You would expect to have more anecdotes than just that one that I've heard.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is worth just saying that birds had an incredibly bad rep for many years. Like, you know, birds.
That's true. Yeah,
like,
yeah,
people
yeah.
are like, oh, birds are stupid.
Yeah.
And I think that we now know that that definitely is not the case. Like, birds, particularly like corvids, very smart. And there's been, you know, there's a talking parrot called Alex that's quite famous that learned quite a lot of symbols. Like birds, not all birds, but there are definitely some smart birds.
But there's enough people keeping chickens, aren't there, that you would have heard. If they were capable of something like that, you'd have heard more stories. And literally, that's the only time I've ever heard of a chicken sort of basically using cognition to save another chicken's life.
Chicken feel, with respect both to chickens and sheep, a bit like the sort of the sheep of the bird world to me. Like just bozos.
Yeah.
Broadly. There's a nice, in terms of actually, so taking it on a slightly different angle, thinking about how we try to understand what the animals are trying to express rather than trying to force our various sort of language attempts on them. There's a nice AI program that can recognize a sheep's kind of emotional state, or specifically whether a sheep is in pain. Like, it's quite hard, like, for a farmer to figure out whether a sheep is in pain or not.
Right.
But there's a kind of facial recognition algorithm.
Oh, so it's sort
pretty
of
well.
Grimacing.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, not, but yes.
Yeah.
Like a sheep grimace. And so if you just put that, as it's going through the gate and you have this thing just running, it will just pick them out really quickly so you can give it, you know, medical attention or whatever.
Yeah.
It's quite cool.
Yeah. I mean, they should expand that up, shouldn't they? Not just grimacing with pain, but feeling quite pleased with themselves or something like that. Yeah. A smug expression on the sheep.
Yeah. This one needs taken down a peg or two. Yeah. This one always looks so bloody pleased with itself.
Yeah. Bored. Right. We'll see to that. Send out the sheepdog.
So we actually asked Barbara, does the answer to communicating with animals lie with exactly that, trying to better understand what they're already communicating?
I also really find myself wanting to turn the question around and ask, why don't we humans see how we can increase our ability to understand what animals are already telling us? You know, there's a cliche that we have to speak for other animals. They're voiceless and we have to take up for them. But I don't think that's true at all. I mean, we know by looking at their behavior that animals want to live their natural lives. And if they are confined to laboratories or taken to the slaughterhouse or made to perform in theme parks, they're communicating really well to us. Their depression, their desire to live free of physical or emotional pain. So I think really, if I could speak to animals, you know, one of the first things I would do is apologize, because we're not very good at letting them live naturally or listening to what they're telling us. They are definitely talking, you know, that's, again, a word that I would qualify, because we usually mean that vocally, but in their own ways, they're talking to us every single day. You know, I've devoted my recent years to studying the expression of animal emotion, particularly animal grief, animal love, things like this. And I understand that when we look again from the ground up at how animals are behaving, we don't have to try to read their minds. Their behavioral cues are telling us a lot about how they problem solve, how they feel, how they go about their days. And so the framework that asks them to fit into our human communication systems, the Dr. Doolittle approach, is fascinating, and I understand it. But ethically, we are really, really compelled to try to go about it another way.
You're going to be apologizing to your cat?
I don't think so. I mean, the important thing is she wouldn't understand if I was apologising. I need to figure out a way of, like, what would a cat language apology be?
I don't know. I mean, you're basically feeding your cat, aren't you, and housing it. And is it he or she?
She.
She. You're housing her. I mean, you've got nothing to apologise for, have you?
I would argue no.
I mean, generally, sort of, I'm not apologising to Raffi one moment.
Yeah, I feel like, if anything, I'm sort of enslaved by her. But I wonder if there are definitely those moments where there's a sort of palpable frustration in both directions.
Yeah.
Where my cat, and people will know this feeling for sure, is meowing at me, and I know she's not hungry, and she's trying to express something. I have no idea what that is.
Yeah,
I'm literally asking her. She doesn't know what I'm saying, and we're just as kind of an impasse. But it doesn't feel beyond the realms to me that, again, using AI, spotting patterns, we might be able to, as Professor Slobodchikov.
Nice work.
As he thinks, that we might have a kind of device that enables us to translate. And I guess the best thing is if it's kind of like a sort of Babelfish type thing. So I say, what is it that you want? And then it spits out the sort of cat. I don't feel I'm going to be learning cat. I'm going to have to have something else.
But I honestly don't see there being a cat equivalent of what is it that you want. I don't think cats would have evolved to ask each other that kind of thing. So,
but I suppose what you could do is you might be able to cycle through the options.
Yes.
So, there's a kind of finite number of things that the cat can want. So it's sort of, do you want to be stroked? Do you want some water? Do you want some food? Are you in pain? Like, and they might have. So if you could work out what those were, you could just sort of put those.
From my perspective with Raffi, you know, we've had to work very hard to work out what it is that she is trying to communicate at any one moment, because you get it wrong and you lose a finger. So, you know, so we know that she, if she wants attention, she'll come and she'll play bow. And there's all these kind of, you know, signals that animals use to each other. So dogs will use towards each other as well. So you have to learn to read their body language. And I guess humans have been working together with dogs for so many thousands of years that we've become quite good at sort of knowing how to interpret that kind of thing and passing that on to the next generation. So I think, you know, when we first got her, we had to do a lot of reading and sort of, you know, almost watching videos of like, oh, this is what a dog does. This is what this tail wag means. And so we sort of have been learning what she's trying to communicate and what mental state she's in. And I think there are things like, you know, she recognizes her name now, which she didn't when we first got her. As a rescue, she didn't, you know, she didn't respond to her name. So she's learned cues like walk and tea and breakfast, and you know, and you can see that she's like, oh, this is going to happen now when I say a certain word. And I'm pretty sure. I mean, it might be to do with the tone of the word as well, the way that we say it and stuff.
Yeah, but that's true for us as well.
Yeah, definitely so, communication going on.
Yeah, you know, there's a project to find really, really smart dogs. It is all border collies.
Of course it is. Yeah, they're amazing.
They're by far the smartest. But there are some that are like super, as you'd expect, some that are like really, really smart.
Yeah.
And have learnt. And you can sort of put your dog up. If you think you've got a smart dog, and it will be a border collie, put it up and they'll see what it's got.
Wow.
But they've learnt sort of, it's something like between 11 and 37 or something, discrete sort of labels for toys. Which is pretty good.
Wow,
so you can have them all laid out on the floor, and then go get the dolly with the gammy eye, and they're like, no problem, just go and get it. That's nice.
Yeah,
that's
that
impressive.
Is good. Yeah, because I mean, we have that thing that we say, oh, you know, all dolphins or all dogs or all cats, and actually they have different sort of intellectual abilities, don't they?
Presumably,
true of dogs. I mean, some dogs are just dumb, aren't they?
But within, I guess it's slightly more surprising within breed.
But there is, from this
border collie study, for sure.
Yeah.
Like, most of the border collies can't learn very much.
But some are really clever, seemingly
really clever. But I think you're right. I think if I'm looking to answer this question of will we ever talk to animals, I think it's going to come down to us trying to listen to what they're trying to say, rather than us trying to impose our language. It feels like a more fruitful way of going to me.
But also, I think we should get the most intelligent border collies and just breed them to be ever more intelligent. And at some point, maybe one of them will break out and say, Okay, that's enough, people.
Mm. I don't like it when you do your little sort of non-scientific jokes. Because that's just silly, Michael. That's not going to happen.
But you could breed in, you know, more and more intelligence, you could, surely.
Yeah. You know, Michael Brooks, the famous dog eugenicist. Yeah, that guy. Yeah, I know that guy. Although, let's not get started on dog breeding and its relationship to eugenics, which is basically, it is eugenics.
Yeah, it is. It's horrible, isn't it?
Really horrible.
Okay, can we just cut the entire sort of section there after what you said?
Yeah. So we're going to keep in the section where you start talking about trying to breed clever dogs. Good stuff. So that's what we think. We should probably see what the expert thinks about the question, will we ever be able to talk to animals? So over to Professor King again.
Well, my impulse is to ask, will we ever listen to the animals? But in fairness, I think we can best approach that question by, at the very least, supplementing our desire to have animals use our language by insisting that we talk to the animals by using their language. And if we do that, I think we will get much closer to mutual attunement and mutual understanding.
I think Professor King sort of broadly agrees with us.
I think so, yeah. That's quite a beautiful idea, isn't it? You know, that kind of mutual understanding. And obviously we're going to have to stop just talking louder and slower and actually sort of make an effort and actually learn some of the way that they talk.
Yeah, I mean, I assume that with most of them, we're going to have some sort of machine that does it for us.
Yeah, probably.
And I'm not. I mean, I'm trying to learn Mandarin at the moment,
and of course
I can't.
You are.
And I can't do that. And I think that and I suspect
how's that going?
That speaking terribly. And I suspect that speaking dolphin is going to be a factor at least harder.
Yeah, I think it probably is. But you know, I mean, we've got like Google Translate now, so AI and the kind of technologies that we've got enables humans to effectively speak into a machine and the machine speaks to the other human. Mm-hmm. So it's not implausible, is it, that we can do that with animals?
Not at all.
I like it. I'm excited.
I think what's interesting is how that will change the way that we will potentially change the way that we treat animals. Because I know that we naturally anthropomorphize. That's just what we do. But if we could literally understand what they were trying to say and communicate sometimes, I think that would really, that would have quite a radical impact on our relationship with animals.
I think
generally,
in some ways, it's what we've avoided finding out, isn't it? We don't want to know how much we're exploiting them.
Yeah, because we saw, I mean, we do know.
Yeah, we do
know.
We
don't want it absolutely confirmed by the animal itself. Yeah. Are you enjoying yourself in that abattoir? Eureka is a Stack production presented by me, Rick Edwards, and Dr. Michael Brooks. The production team is Andrea Lucia Peters, Luke Moore, and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to Professor Barbara J. King, Emerita Professor of Anthropology at the College of William and Mary. If you like the show, please do subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. Makes a massive difference. You can also find us on Twitter at EurekaPod. Thanks very much.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
What's the first thing you'd say to your dog? To my cat, it's just a very short, sharp, what? Just what is it? Spit it out.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.